Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up, Donald Trump declares peace as hostages are freed, but questions still linger over who controls Gaza. 140 million rand return to families as the Life Ombud rewrites the ending of declined insurance claims. Global payments are being ripped from their old foundations by new technology and shifting power blocks. And the mountain of e-waste is exploding and the financial sector can no longer afford to look away. It's Tuesday, the 14th of October. Now, after 2 years of devastating war, Hamas has released the last living 20 Israeli hostages. Israel has freed roughly between 1,700 and 2,000 Palestinian detainees, all under a ceasefire deal brokered by the United States, Egypt, Qatar, and Turkey. President Trump has declared in Jerusalem that the war in Gaza is over, leaders then gathering in Egypt to sign a ceasefire framework. Yet, I think complex and difficult questions still remain about disarmament, about governance in Gaza, and who guarantees the peace. In that respect, I'm joined now by international relations analyst, former South African diplomat Zinat Adam, to discuss what's fact, what's political theatre, and what comes next for the Palestinians and for the Israelis. So, Zinat, first of all, welcome, and a headline check maybe. What is actually signed or agreed? What are the ceasefire terms? Are there specific timelines? And perhaps most importantly, guarantors?
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me. The guarantor is seemingly Trump, and I think that's what we witnessed yesterday in the presentation at the Knesset by Trump, and then in Sharm el-Sheikh with the adulation of him, signifying the Arab and Muslim leaders' broad endorsement of a peace plan. But in actuality, the devil is in the detail, as they say, and those issues are still not yet agreed upon. So we've managed to come to this first part of the peace plan, which was a ceasefire, a gradual withdrawal of Israeli troops from some of the areas, and then the release of the hostages and the Palestinian detainees. But what comes next is still very vague in terms of what has actually been signed in terms of the peace plan. We know that Israel currently still holds a depopulated area of about 58% of Gaza. And after an international force enters, which is one of the proposals in terms of the peace plan, that Israel will withdraw to about 40% of the Gaza land. Part of that international force, I understand to be Indonesian troops that would be deployed, but the detail of that is still very vague.
Reuters is reporting today that Hamas has temporary leeway on internal security in the territory. I wonder if that is a pragmatic stopgap, or do you think that maybe it could be some kind of contradiction?
Certainly, Hamas has indicated very firmly that they will not be interested in a disarmament unless it is a DDR, or disarmament and integration into a Palestinian-led governance force. And so temporarily, they are still being allowed to have some kind of security within certain pockets and areas of Gaza. But what is concerning, and this is something that the Palestinians raised about 18 months ago, is that there have been militia that apparently are supported by Israel. And the concern over this is that it would spark internal conflict between those militia and Hamas-led resistance fighters.
And difficult to get around that. There are huge risks attached to that then.
Exceptionally, and for me, it just brings back memories of how the situation in Iraq transpired, and the difficulty of being able to maintain law and order in an area that has experienced such harsh conditions over the last 2 years, and without actually yet having some kind of a security force. So until and unless that international force that is planned is actually deployed, there's a lot of risk within the Gaza Strip.
Do we know how long it's going to take for that international force to be put together and then mobilized?
So from the Qatari mediators, there's very little information that's come through, and they've said that they're trying to work with it in different segments. And so that hasn't really been clarified as timelines, or it hasn't been made public as yet. But the understanding is that once the hostages and the detainees were released, that immediately there would be negotiations to those details, and there would be an immediate plan of deployment. But until now, we don't have a timeline.
Zeenat, the prisoner-hostage swaps that we witnessed yesterday were dramatic. What do the numbers and maybe the categories of release tell us about leverage that might exist on either side?
I think it's important to bear in mind that the numbers of administrative detention detainees from Palestine more than doubled from the 7th of October 2023. It was sitting at approximately 4,000 at that time and is over the 11,000 mark right now. So we've had approximately 2,000 people who have been released. Many of them are children. Many are from Gaza, who had been abducted from hospitals and from some of the areas, most of them civilians. Some are showing indications of torture in detention. But there were also a number, probably about 250 high-profile detainees who had been given life sentences or multiple life sentences and have now been released. And those have been sent to their families, but there are quite a number who have been marked for deportation.
Could you reflect for me on reconstruction as this process moves forward? Who pays? How will aid corridors and border crossings be kept open and secure? And what kind of money are we looking at here, do you think?
This is going to be in the billions. I think that the last figure that I came across was looking at approximately $52 billion just to try and reconstruct Gaza, but it may go even further than that. Now, some people are very concerned that this is disaster capitalism, that this would be profiteering from the rebuilding of Gaza, and that it is, in fact, economic colonialism in a different light. But if it's not done with the people of Gaza and in collaboration with them, I think it's going to be very damaging. The plan that was put forward by Tony Blair some months ago is not very constructive and is not very much taking into consideration what the Palestinian voice would be. And that's concerning. But the Arab and Muslim leaders who have come around the table and were at Sharm el-Sheikh yesterday have pledged that they would want to be part of that. And I would imagine that many of the Gulf states would be pledging the most amount of money towards this reconstruction.
I'm going to need a very quick answer, but from a South African vantage point, how does Pretoria now recalibrate its diplomacy?
I think that there needs to be a distinction between peace and justice. And right now, there might be a peace that is negotiated, but justice has not yet been delivered. And South Africa is very much important in the delivery of that justice through the ICJ case at The Hague.
Zeenat Adam, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, not every insurance claim story needs to end in frustration. In fact, some end with dignity restored and lives changed. What am I talking about? Well, since the beginning of this year, the Life Insurance Division at the National Financial Ombuds Scheme South Africa, the NFO, has helped recover something in the region of 140 million rand in previously declined or disputed claims. That's money that's gone back into the hands of, I guess, grieving families and more vulnerable policyholders. These are quiet wins that seldom make the headlines, but they carry real weight. Restoring trust, they close painful chapters and also hold insurers to their obligations. I want to discuss this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Denise Gabriels, who is lead ombud for life insurance at the NFO. Denise, welcome to you. Let's start with that headline number, 140 million rand recovered so far this year. In your opinion, what does that figure represent in real human terms?
Hi, good afternoon. It's obviously money that has been recovered for complainants to our office in respect of mostly claims that were previously declined and that have now been upheld by our office. Also, part of that is some compensation for poor service delivered by insurers. So that's only on the life insurance side.
So why do so many claims get turned down in the first place? What's the problem here?
Could be one of many reasons. Often it's the claims declined initially by the insurer, sometimes because of poor documentation or incomplete documentation having been delivered to them. The complainant not necessarily having read all the terms and conditions of the policy carefully, but we do go into it a little bit in more detail sometimes, taking into account the circumstances under which the policy was sold, what representations were made to the policyholder at the application stage. Sometimes it's waiting periods or claims that have been submitted late, and there are time barring exclusions on the contract. And then we would look at it from a perspective of fairness, what's fair to both parties.
Do we have a situation often where either the companies themselves or brokers, for that matter, are simply taking advantage of more vulnerable people? Those people, maybe, as you've suggested, that don't read the small print sufficiently.
There is obviously some instances of that occurring. Sometimes it's a matter of representations, the true representations being made to the advisor, the financial advisor, the broker, and that not necessarily being conveyed correctly to the insurer. So, for example, medical questions that are answered, we do sometimes get complaints where the person says, but they've given the correct information to the advisor who didn't necessarily deem it important or for whatever reason, filled, you know, something different, completed the form application form differently. Or in funeral insurance policies, what we've seen lately is they cover a wide range of lives insured. So it doesn't only have to be the policyholder, but sometimes the spouse, the grandparent, the children, etc. And sometimes that relationship is not correctly described to the insurer initially, and there could be a discrepancy between what was told to the advisor and what the advisor conveyed to the insurer. And those are also some of the cases that we've managed to uphold in favor of complainants.
So, Denise, if someone believes their claim has been unfairly rejected, what is the first practical step they need to take before coming to a body such as yours?
To complain to the insurer itself. Set out the circumstances under which the policy was sold, because sometimes they're also sold, you know, telephonically or online, or sometimes even at a toll point. What was the situation there? What was told to the advisor and why you believe the claim should be upheld? Make sure you also give the correct documentation that is required. I'd also advise all policyholders or prospective policyholders to answer questions fully and truthfully, you know, when they do take out the application form. But if they have and they feel that the claim is wrongfully declined, complain to the insurer. And if they do not respond in your favor and you still feel aggrieved, our services are free.
So at which point you come in, as you say, with free services, how does your mediation process work when that claim then has been declined and the person is not getting sufficient joy from the insurer?
So what happens is that if we cannot see that the person has complained to the insurer directly initially, we would send it to the insurer to give them an opportunity to resolve the complaint directly with the complainant. If that's still not resolved, or in cases where the insurer has responded but still stuck to their guns, and the policyholder still aggrieved or the claimant is still aggrieved, We will then take up the complaint. We will again ask the insurer to give their side. We would then give both parties an opportunity to state their case. Often this is it's a reiterative process because sometimes, one would respond to the other's allegations. We give them both opportunities to do so. And in that case, ultimately, we will try to negotiate or mediate between the parties. If that fails, we'll make a recommendation.
Denise, finally, what message do you have for South Africans who think they can't fight a big insurer?
I think there are many dispute mechanisms in place, especially for insurers, and the NFO deals with banks and credit complaints as well. So it's free, it's impartial, and it's informal and quite accessible. You can complain in any language to us. As you said earlier, Jeremy, 146.6 million rand has been awarded this year so far by the life insurance division alone. Short-term insurance also deals with complaints, as I said, the banking and credit divisions, they too deal with complaints. And we do take up the complaint. We're not a consumer advocate. We try and resolve these fairly and impartially between the two parties. But we kind of level the playing fields because we will investigate the complaint on your behalf as well. We do not just take. We understand that there are vulnerable consumers and not everybody understands all the jargon, etc. And as the financial literacy to take up a complaint with the insurer, but we do that. And we will investigate it thoroughly as well.
Well, that is very reassuring to hear. Denise Gabriels, thank you very much indeed. Lead Ombudsman for Life Insurance at the National Financial Ombuds Scheme, South Africa. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the way in which money is moving around the world is undergoing a once-in-a-generation transformation, driven by rising customer expectations, rapid technical innovation, and shifting geopolitical realities. Payments are no longer just a back-office function. They are becoming a strategic lever for growth, for inclusion, and competitiveness. Instant payments, cross-border remittances, digital identity, and fintech innovation are all colliding to reshape the global financial landscape. It is an important issue, and I want to explore this in a little more detail with Dr. Leo Lippis, who's Chief Executive Officer of Lippis Advisors and one of the world's foremost experts on how money is really moving behind the scenes. So, Leo, a very warm welcome to you. We're living through what many are calling the most profound shift in the way in which money moves. When you look at everything from instant payments to digital identity, cross-border remittance, what do you see as the biggest single force that is driving this current transformation?
Well, I think the biggest force driving the transformation is the need for payment systems to be open and to be more inclusive and to help modernize the digital economy. One of the things we're seeing in a variety of ways, and this is true in developing economies as well as advanced economies, is that people's behaviors are changing. People's expectations are changing. That the payment systems that were built 50 years ago were built for good reason, the way they were. And they were built to be process transactions in batch mode. They were built to process transactions as quickly as was possible at the time. However, over the last 50 years, our expectations have changed and the payment system has to evolve along with it. So that we're seeing, for example, increases in the speed, decreases in the cost, increases in the transparency of transactions, as well as, last but not least, increases in accessibility. And so these are all important factors that are driving, I think, the development of payments, both domestic and cross-border, and in both from consumers, for corporates, in all different ways.
And you also suggest that instant payment is no longer just about speed. It's a lot bigger than that. It's really reshaping economies and financial access, and I would imagine predominantly in developing economies.
Yeah, well, and there's good reason for that. I mean, instant payments really do matter. They're cheaper, they're faster, they're better, they're more inclusive, they're more environmentally sustainable. On the one hand, they're cheaper for merchants and for corporates to accept. In particular, when you compare them with cards, there are no fees for accepting instant payments, for example, in the vast majority of countries. There's no terminal required to do it, right? So they don't have the hardware costs involved with that. They're faster because the funds availability is instant. It's guaranteed. It's irrevocable. They're better because of the types of services that are typically built around them. If you look at, for example, what's happening in India with its UPI, the Unified Payments Interface, as well as in PIX, the system in Brazil, we're seeing lots of variety of services being built around that for usage at the point of sale. So in typical retail shops, for remittances, both domestic and cross-border, we're seeing those systems being extended beyond borders so that, for example, Indian expats or Indian migrants outside of India can send money back to their families and so on. So the types of services that are typically built around them are much richer, much more robust. They're also more inclusive because of the low barriers for acceptance by merchants and by usage by consumers. You enable participation in the modern digital economy far better for a much greater number of people because all you need typically is a smartphone. They're also more environmentally sustainable because they're digitally native. We aren't mimicking paper processes in the background using these. These are digitally native systems. So at the same time, not all these systems have the same impact. We need to get them right. It's important to structure the incentives correctly so that people, you know, want to use them, payments want to accept them, and that all the stakeholders that operate them get something out of it too.
Leo, let me pick you up on your use of the word smartphone, and I'd suggest that with every advance, as you've outlined to us, there is huge risk attached to it, and there must surely be one where the speed of payment is outpacing the security that is needed to protect them. That's always an overhang, isn't it?
It is. Fraud is certainly a concern, or scams are a concern. But let me say that I wouldn't say that real-time payment systems do not create new fraud. They don't necessarily create the opportunity for new fraud. What they do is, because they're faster, they tend to attract fraud from other places. And so, but I think we need to put the numbers, I think, in a bit of perspective. So we look, you know, reliable studies, when I look around the world, estimate the value of fraud in the cards world to be about 0.03% of transaction value. That means for every 1,000 Rand transmitted or transacted, about 30 cents is lost in fraud. It's not a lot, right? There's no reason to believe that real-time system, or that the fraud in real-time payment systems exceeds that. What I think has changed in the world, and what is changing because of the way in which real-time systems operate, is a shift from what we call unauthorized fraud, where, for example, I might steal someone else's card details and perpetrate a card fraud by using their card number, or I might impersonate somebody, right, and create a, and send a transaction from their account. What has changed is a shift from that towards scams, where I dupe somebody into sending me money. And this is a serious problem. I don't mean to underplay it, but it doesn't undermine confidence, I don't think, in the payment system as such. What it means is that we as consumers or as business owners need to be more vigilant about to whom and in what amounts we send people money.
It's also about seamless integration, is it not? And I can't help but wonder whether banks and fintechs these days are genuinely collaborating on payment innovation, or is it still a turf war?
Well, it appears, at least from the outside, to be a turf war, but there's a lot of cooperation happening behind the scenes. In fact, I'm just in the process now of arranging a seminar in late November. So it's about, 6 weeks hence. And I'm just in the process of arranging this seminar that focuses on collaboration between banks and the fintech industry to improve the user experience in cross-border payments. Now, that's just one example. But there are a variety of ways in which this is really happening behind the scenes. And there are a variety of ways in which it's happening actually in ways that the user can actually see and experience themselves. There are, for example, cross-border payment services that rely upon non-banks for executing those payments. There are a variety, I think, of domestic payment initiation schemes that allow people or corporations for that matter, to initiate payments via a third party or by a non-bank. So the ways in which these cooperations, we often refer to it as coopetition for that very good reason. It enables services that banks themselves aren't able to innovate or provide on their own, and allows users, I think, a different kind of experience as a result of that.
And that's where we are going to leave it. Dr. Leo Lippis, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, Lippis Advisors, I do appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
E-waste, I read, is now growing 3 times faster than municipal waste in South Africa, and less than 1% of it is recycled. That is a staggering statistic with serious environmental, legal, and business implications. What am I talking about? Well, from laptops and smartphones to printers and servers, every device eventually reaches the end of its life. The question is, who's responsible for what happens next? For businesses, this isn't just about doing the right thing. It's about compliance, it's about ESG strategy, and even unlocking some value from old technology, would you believe? Let's pull all of this together. I'm in conversation with Evan Berger, Chief Executive Officer, Go Rentals. It's a company specializing in technology rentals and lifestyle management solutions. Evan, welcome to you. Just how serious then is this e-waste problem?
Jeremy, it's a growing crisis globally and in South Africa as well. There is a focus on it and things are heading in the right direction, but it is a crisis, both from an environmental perspective, but when one talks in the corporate space and financial services space, it's also a data and governance risk because all of these devices contain data.
Could you explain to me just how serious or how the environmental risk actually manifests?
Well, Jeremy, improper disposal has a number of risks. And in informal sectors, devices are often broken down in ways which are harmful to the environment, where metals, minerals that can be reused are extracted, and then the toxic elements that can't be are then dumped improperly into municipal landfills, streams, and the likes. And the issue is that we can't seem to keep ahead of the e-waste crisis. As you know, we all work with multiple devices. There's just so many devices that are being imported, coming into the country, both personal and business devices, that the crisis is increasing.
So it begs the question, Evan, I guess, why so many companies then lack clear plans for retiring or recycling IT equipment?
Yeah, there really hasn't been enough focus on the business and corporate side, retiring old assets. I think that many organizations focus on the minimum compliance. And I think that it's something that's not too difficult to do by putting the right policies in place. Organizations understanding what their objectives are and putting those compliance, understanding the risks, putting those compliance measures in place and the processes that are required to effectively reduce their risk.
So all about, as you suggest, good policy. So how do you build sustainable, disposable and recycling policy into everyday business operations? I guess you'll tell me it's not something that you look at once a year.
No, I think it's really starting off, as I mentioned, firstly, what the objectives are. Because think of IT disposal. Yes, there is compliance. Compliance is important. But I think, as you mentioned earlier, social responsibility and doing the right thing is really a critical part of it as well, because we do live in a society where there are so many people and communities that don't have access to the technology. So reuse of devices is absolutely critical. And a lot of the buzzwords around sustainability is talking about circularity and reuse of IT equipment. So the social impact side is massive. And I think that's something that all organizations need to really focus on. And once you have that policy in place, you understand what the objectives are. It's something that organizations can achieve by either put the process in place themselves or partner with the right service providers or vendors to help them put this in place, because there are multiple types of IT equipment, you can imagine, from servers to electronics to smartphones, and each has different methods of recycling and disposal and different risks associated with them. So it is important to really break down all aspects of the electronic devices that an organization is using. And map out those policies clearly. And like you say, it's not something that you just do once. You have to continually keep refreshing this.
And of course, Evan, those policies have got to be enforced, and you have regulations like the National Environmental Management Waste Act. But is that being enforced sufficiently, do you think?
I think, Jeremy, it is heading in the right direction. I think that that legislative framework is in place. In many spaces, we see there might not be necessarily the enforcement that there should be, but it is heading in the right direction. I mean, like I said, there are other risks. It's not only e-waste. There's POPI compliance, and that's one of the largest risks that we see. Organizations allowing devices to leave their premises that still contain data. And without a proper policy in place, unfortunately, that happens far too frequently.
And just a final one, there is also advantage in getting this right, because I also mentioned that responsible recycling can unlock value. It's all a question of how to turn old devices into opportunities instead of waste. What's the approach?
Yes, most definitely. So every organization, you know, will have a number of different objectives. One is financial recovering value from old devices, and devices can and do have a second life. So beyond the business or financial services sector, those devices can have a life in a school for a child, to open up opportunities for education and learning. So one, their devices can be resold. There's also development of sectors in the environmental recycling space, from collectors to recycling. There's a number of additional economies that are supported by the disposal of electronic waste.
So let me go and dig out my old Nokia phone. Evan Berger, thank you very much indeed. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.